From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Andrew Malcolm tells us about his decision to take his dying mother off the respirator and let her go. Malcolm is a New York Times reporter and has written many stories about new ethical questions raised by new medical technology. Joel Dorn has produced studio recordings by such performers as the Neville Brothers, Bette Midler, and Roberta Flack. Coming up, he tells us about his new label devoted to live concert recordings. And TV critic David Bianculli checks out Unplugged, MTV's weekly acoustic concert series, this week featuring Paul McCartney. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Security Council approved a resolution today that could bring a formal end to the Gulf War. The resolution lays down terms that Iraq must live by to preserve the current ceasefire. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
The vote on the measure was 12-1, with only Cuba opposing it. Two council members, Ecuador and Yemen, abstained. The resolution says that Iraq must destroy its chemical and biological weapons and promise not to develop nuclear arms. It also must pay damage claims to victims of the war, using a portion of its oil revenues. And it must demarcate its border with Kuwait under the terms of a 1963 agreement between the two countries that Iraq now disputes. Most of the Iraqi trade sanctions will stay in effect, but could be lifted later. In Florida, President Bush called on Iraq to accept the resolution, saying it is now up to Iraq to demonstrate that it is prepared to accept the will of the world community. But Iraqi officials so far have refused to say whether they will accept the resolution, only that they are studying it. In New York, this is Jim Zeroli reporting.
The situation for hundreds of thousands of Kurds in northern Iraq is described as critical today. NPR's John Hockenberry reports from Ankara, where the government has appealed for humanitarian assistance in handling the wave of refugees.
It is believed that 200,000 residents of northern Iraq are attempting to gain entry into Turkey, and Turkish officials say that many thousands have crossed since the influx became desperate last weekend. Turkish authorities say they are constructing new refugee camps to house the wave of people fleeing the fighting. The area of the Turkish border where most are waiting is rugged, cold, and exposed to the elements. Relief officials say that perhaps 2 million are fleeing the populated areas, mostly Kurds, but also ethnic Turks, who it is reported are getting first priority in crossing into Turkey. Relief officials say that the refugees fear an Iraqi attempt to seal the border now with military force. At that point, observers and refugees say the slaughter by Iraqi troops will begin. This is John Hockenberry in Ankara.
Environmentalists said today that the Bush administration is preparing legislation to override rulings protecting the northern spotted owl in the Pacific Northwest. Wilderness Society President George Frampton said that the White House has a secret plan to override the Endangered Species Act and other laws to allow the timber industry to continue logging. A timber industry spokesman said that the plan in question was being developed by industry and labor groups without formal support from the White House. Mark Ray of the American Forest Resource Alliance said that environmentalists were making ludicrous claims in an effort to turn President Bush against the proposal. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 18 points today to close at 2,926.73. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2 in heavy trading. Volume was 214 million shares. This is NPR News. A group of environmental scientists called today for a massive commitment of U.S. military help to put out the oil well fires in Kuwait. The scientists said that the military is needed to clear away mines, booby traps, and unexploded bombs in the oil fields. They warned that the munitions are slowing the efforts of American firefighters and well cappers who are trying to deal with more than 500 burning wells. The scientists said there's an even greater danger from the non-burning wells that are spewing oil onto the desert and ultimately into underground water supplies. Tensions remain high in the Yugoslav Republic of Croatia following Monday's declaration by ethnic Serbian leaders to unite regions under their control with Serbia. Large detachments of the Yugoslav army are patrolling Serbian regions of Croatia to try to prevent bloodshed. Pierre Vickery reports.
Dozens of tanks and armored vehicles of the Yugoslav People's Army are deployed at major crossroads in three parts of Croatia, where ethnic Serbs are in the majority. Heavy military traffic has been reported in Lika and Slavonia as the army attempts to create a buffer zone between armed Serbian vigilantes and units of the Croatian paramilitary police. Many roads in central Croatia are blocked, and the railroad junction at Knin, a Serbian stronghold, is impassable. In the federal capital, Belgrade, an emergency meeting of the presidency, the country's collective leadership, is discussing security in the country. The defense ministry wants the army to remain until the crisis is resolved. But most Yugoslavs believe the unrest is being deliberately encouraged from Serbia. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
A Federal Reserve survey released today indicates that although fewer banks are tightening their lending practices, not many are actually making it easier to get credit. The poll is designed to gauge the so-called credit crunch. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I want to read you something journalist Andrew Malcolm wrote after he decided to let his dying mother go in peace by taking her off the respirator that was keeping her alive. He wrote, "I don't think anyone can ever be fully prepared for the death of a parent, especially today. In the past, a son or daughter had to accept the loss and handle the funeral arrangements, terrible enough to be sure. Today, in addition to that painful burden, middle-aged men and women are routinely asked to participate in deciding when and how a parent dies." Malcolm explains how he made the difficult decision about his mother in his new book, Someday. The book is the story of his mother's life as well as her death, and about the relationship of mother and son. Malcolm is a national affairs correspondent for the New York Times, and he's written many stories on the ethical quandaries created by new medical technology. When he was growing up, the majority of Americans died at home, like his grandfather did.
He was in his own bed, in his own bedroom, with pictures of his daughter and his brothers on the dresser, and his wool vest on with the chain across the front. And everyone in the family was gathered around the bed, and we all remember his last words, which were, "Get this big stone off my chest." It was sad, but everyone was prepared to accept it. God seemed to be making those decisions. And the family doctor was there, but it seemed presumptuous to take someone to a hospital at that time, because what could they do? But today, we've got all this wonderful medical technology. Unfortunately, we haven't included the moral instructions with it, but we do have this medical technology, and it's all gathered in the hospitals. And death really, as Russell Baker says, doesn't make house calls anymore. So 80% of the deaths in the United States occur in institutions where we can put these people out of our misery. And as a result, as I say, 70% of all deaths now are somehow negotiated or timed, according to the American Hospital Association. And that is, when do we stop doing all the things that we can do, and which ones do we stop, and at what point? And our society has always dealt with death as the one inevitable that we can dodge. If we don't talk about it, it won't come. And death is the D word. And as a result, suddenly families are confronted with these decisions, as was I, even though I'd been covering it.
You had written New York Times stories about medical ethics and about the difficult decisions families have to make about loved ones who are dying. But had you ever discussed the issue of living wills or anything like that with your mother when she got sick?
Well, I had mentioned the stories as I wrote them to her. She got the newspaper. She was not all that eager to follow my stories, whatever they were about, which is part of the problem that we had. In some ways, personally, I guess I always felt I never really could please her, and I would call up and say, well, there's this story in there. And she was very pleased to tell her friends that she had a son who worked for the New York Times and who wrote books. But judging by her conversation, she never really got around to reading many of them. At some points, I would try to lead her into this discussion intellectually. I didn't really fully realize what I was getting into, but I'd say things like, well, Mom, I don't really consider 1 in 10,000 a very good chance, you know, being on all these machines and everything. What do you think? I try to hit it obliquely. And she would say things like, well, I don't want to stay past my time, or I don't like all those machines, or your father was lucky he went quickly. And briefly, I thought, well, good, then I've got some guidance there, until I got outside her apartment and I realized that, well, who's going to be left to figure out whose time it was? It was going to be me, the only son of two only children who were my parents. And I really wasn't any farther along than I had been before.
How did you finally bring it up to her?
She was in a nursing home, and this is a few months before the end, and she had not been well. And she kept saying, well, you know, I didn't want this to go on like this. I said, oh, come on, Mom, you know, the way we talk, you're going to outlive me and blah, 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 and say all the cliche things because you really don't want to address the immediate issue. And she said, boy, look at that cat out there in that tree. And there was no cat in the tree. And every day at the same time, she would see this cat, and there were other animals that she would see in the tree. And then a couple of hours later, she's perfectly fine. The doctors call it the sundown syndrome, and sometimes elderly minds get a little foggy late in the afternoon. And that was kind of a warning. I took it as a warning, and I went and arranged for it, what's called a durable power of attorney. Gave me the power to make medical decisions for her in the event that she was incapacitated. And so I was the proxy decision maker. It cleared the waters considerably. So I was determined to take some control. The irony, from my point of view, personally, the sadness was that I knew intellectually, but the dilemma for me was that the only way I felt I could live up to the values that they had taught me was to let her go and to let nature take its course. As one priest said to me later, you have to decide personally in your heart, when are we trying to glue the autumn leaves back on? And I decided we were trying to glue the autumn leaves on. But the irony was that by letting her go and living up to those values, that was left me as out in the cold in a way, because I never would get the kinds of affection and attention that I'd always liked to have from her.
At what point in her final days did you think that it was time to start thinking seriously about pulling the life support system?
Well, I knew it in my heart from the very beginning when I went out there the last week, but you don't really talk about it. It's clear and implied, the doctor using ominous terms. In her case, he didn't use the usual football fourth down or the last 2 minute analogy, but with her, he was saying, well, Andrew, we're going to have to be making some serious decisions here. And, you know, what does that mean? Well, you know darn well what that means. And how aggressive do we want to be? I had made it clear because I had made a point of getting to know him, at least on the telephone. We'd never really met. And it turns out he'd been taking notes over the years, make sure I wasn't some kind of a greedy son that was eager to get at whatever estate was left. So there was a feeling out of each other there. And I was not eager to pull any plug. I asked what treatments were there. It was clear that I was not interested in the aggressive ones, no kind of operations involved. I really didn't see the point in that. And her lung had already collapsed when they tried one treatment, so that didn't bode well. And I think it was Sunday, he said, well, we're backing off on the respirator now. And I said, all right, we'll try that. And I was there, of course, pretty much all the time. And that didn't seem to work. And on Monday, he said, well, and I said, well, let's give it another day. And so we did, and that wasn't working. And finally, the next morning, I said, well, we met over there at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I said, well, what's the outlook? And he said, well, it's not good. Even if we did get things back in balance, get the organs working again, in a few months, she might regain consciousness, and then we're faced with the lung cancer. I thought for an hour or so, and then I said, well, I really don't see the point. There was no outlook of any kind of return to a meaningful life. She would never be back the way she'd been even when she was foggy in the nursing home. And so they gave me some time with her, and it was, needless to say, very sad and emotional. And I talked at her. I don't know whether she heard me or not, but I talked at her and explained what I was doing and what we would be doing with the breathing machine, and that she was supposed to breathe by herself, and they couldn't go on with this way, and the machine was scarring her lungs, and her lungs were so fragile because she'd been a heavy smoker. And then we took the breathing machine off, and things gradually declined from there, and 9 hours and 5 minutes later, she passed away. And I was obviously devastated. I didn't, you know, you can't leave the hospital room. I didn't know what to do. And yet, I came home and I said to a friend of mine and I said it very frankly and bluntly, how devastating it was. We had not been all, my mother and I had not been intimately close, but we had been as close. I mean, it's the only mother I had anyway. He said, well, you really should write this. And that's the last thing I really wanted to do. But the more I thought about it, the thought that perhaps some people could learn some lessons and avoid the kinds of pain and difficulty that I had experienced, even knowing what I knew about what was coming. And so I sat down and said, well, where did the values come from that last day in the hospital room that led me to make that decision for her? That took me right, of course, back to my childhood and walk through. And what someday ended up being then was really a journey of joy in a way. It may sound strange to say, but death in our society has become so clinical. There's so many machines between us. She had 16 tubes in her at the end. So many machines reading things that I wasn't sure we needed to know about what was going on in her body chemically. And they're wonderful things as crutches, as medical crutches, to get you over a hurdle. But I didn't think it was much of a life from the values that my parents had taught me anyway, for the long term.
You write that you were struck by how different your mother looked in death than she had looked when she was in a coma. And that made you think that there was really more life in her when she was in a coma than you had thought.
Yes, it's amazing, you know, even seemingly sound asleep, how much life is there. I watched her chest rising and falling, and it did it with a click because the machine was doing it, and it had the size programmed in and everything. And when I first got there, I said, hi, Mom, it's Andy, I'm here, and so forth. And she shaped her mouth in the shape of, oh, you know, like, oh, my. And a few minutes later, I came back, and I said the same thing again, and she shaped her mouth as if it was, oh, you know, like another surprise, and I'm saying the same thing. So you're never quite sure what they hear. And so I told her how much I loved her and recounted all the details of family life up until then, brought her up to date and so forth. Felt a little silly, honestly, in the ICU talking at this biological shell, but on the chance that she might hear it. And I was holding her hands the way she used to when I was sick and stroking her forehead and so forth, trying to be loving. I felt very uncomfortable, to tell you the truth. It was not an easy thing for a man of my generation to do. But I did, and I tried to be comforting in my way, and then every once in a while I would flee out of the room, sometimes go out in the hall and cry, and sometimes go out and get a soda or something and come back. They're very understanding, the nurses in the ICU. I mean, they deal with this all the time, and there had been a man, the day before my mother went there, there had been a man die in the same bed who had gone through quite the same kind of giving up process with the family, except in his case it took 8 or 9 weeks for the family to be agreed that it was time to give up.
If you're just joining us, Andrew Malcolm is my guest, national affairs correspondent for the New York Times. And we're talking about the subject of his new book, Someday, which is about his mother's life and her death. And we'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. New York Times national affairs correspondent Andrew Malcolm is my guest. You write that you had tried for years to prepare yourself for your parents' deaths. When you knew your mother was very sick, did you feel prepared? And at that point, what did you do to prepare yourself? And did that work?
No. I had prepared myself in the sense that I never left a conversation or a visit with harsh words, which we had exchanged frequently over the years. I would always end the phone conversations with, you know, how much I love you, or it was good to talk with you, even when it wasn't. And when I would use a lesson in my personal life, I lived a long way away from my parents, in some particularly powerful way, then I would tell them about it, trying to give them some sense of satisfaction, because I'm a parent myself with 4 children, and I wanted them to know that, you know, these lessons go on.
When you consented to have your mother's respirator removed, was your doctor putting himself in any jeopardy? In other words, could you have sued him if you wanted to? Is that something that your doctor could have rightfully worried about? Because I know in these kinds of decisions, one of the things the doctors are always thinking is this going to lead to a lawsuit?
That's right. Of course they are, especially if it's a divided family, or if there are many members. In my case, it was me.
Yeah, you're an only child.
I'm an only child. My father had passed away already. I probably could have sued him. I don't know what for, but it certainly could have made a mess. I don't think I would have had much grounds because here I was legally the appointed decision maker. It was not me really consenting. You'll notice he did not propose that we remove the respirator. This was left to me to say.
Yeah, well, explain the language of that so everything is kind of on the up and up for both parties.
Sure.
Because there's the legal as well as the emotional aspects that you have to deal with simultaneously.
Well, I dealt in generalities like we'll do everything or make her comfortable or I don't want to be intrusive or I didn't want to be cutting into her and putting things in. I didn't see the point to that. Of course, I saw a very compelling point to making her comfortable. He was in very much agreement with that. If we had come to the point, let's say, that she did survive off the respirator but remained in a coma, sometime down the road we might have gotten to the point where we decide whether we continue pumping this orange chemical slurry up her nose for nutrition or whether we go and surgically implant a tube in her stomach. But at the end he was saying, well, what do you want to do? He didn't say, well, we'll take this off and we'll do that and we'll do that. And I was saying, well, is there any chance of coming back to a meaningful life? And he thought, no. Had he checked with others? Yes. I just walked through everything I could think of as a reporter, all the avenues of exploring for my mother's care, also to protect myself from guilt, because I didn't want, you know, right now suddenly to be stricken with, oh my gosh, I never thought about this. Why didn't we try that? And then I said, well, I really don't see the point to continuing on the respirator. We did not get to the point of discussion of removing the chemical nutrition. You know, this is not chicken soup, and I find that to me, in a way, that's almost more offensive than the breathing machine.
Why?
I don't know. It's a very emotional issue, feeding and nutrition, and you have this impression of someone holding their head in their arms and putting the warm liquid full of vitamins to your lips. It's not. It's someone standing by a bedside with a plastic tube that they've gone up your nose, and they do it just like a plunger, and there's this whoosh, and this orange stuff goes right up your nose and goes down into your stomach. And I was moved so terribly to come in to the room and see this little tiny woman. I wasn't sure it was my mother in the dark. And I was hoping it wasn't, but of course it was. Under the sheets there, and then lift up the sheet, try to find her hand to hold her hand, and they were tied to the bedsides.
They were tied to the bedsides because she tried to pull out the tube from her nose.
Right. And I said, you know, the technicians will say, well, you know, people do try to do that. It's uncomfortable. And I'd say, well, have you ever had a tube up your nose? And most of them, of course, had not. They're very well-meaning. And I said, well, it may be uncomfortable. I suppose there's another reason, too, isn't there? And there's dead silence. And, of course, the other reason is that she didn't want to go on like that. And when I said that to the doctor at the end, he said, you're absolutely right. And, of course, it was up to me to decide, and I'm the one who knew her the best. At one point, they untied her hands, and she took her right hand, it had a gizmo on it that shines a light through it and reads the blood gases and how well the lungs are working, and made her finger look like E.T.'s, you know. She'd move her hand, and pointing this glowing finger in the dark. It was really creepy. Anyway, they untied her hands, and she took her right hand, and she went up towards her mouth, which was where all the tubes were. And the technician reached out like lightning and grabbed her wrist. I said, no, wait a minute. And he let go, and she went up and played with her lower lip the way she used to all the time when I was a kid. She would nervously purse her lower lip with her fingers. And, of course, if I needed anything else to tell me that was my mother, that was it. But at least let her do it.
What, based on your experience and on the experiences of others who you've written about for the New York Times, what kinds of, new hospital regulations or whatever legal precedents would you like to see that would make these kinds of decisions more humane?
Well, I think the most important thing is for families to talk amongst themselves. This is where the values spring. We need to have channels open through legislatures for living wills and all the legal paraphernalia that comes with these kinds of things in our society anyway. But the most important thing is that families talk amongst themselves, even obliquely. Something's better than nothing. And that they make these wishes known to the doctor. I've sat in on negotiations involving deaths in which their brothers and sisters, all of them are there, all of them are saddened. Maybe a couple of them don't want to let the person go, even though it's hopeless. And yet they do know what the patient's wishes were, and they all abide by them. It's very compelling when a family appears with a doctor united in what they want to do. Now, we're not talking about united in getting at the estate, and we're not talking about someone, you know, a non-terminal illness here. We're talking about in the final days. But it's very easy to convince yourself, if you have an aggressive doctor that you haven't really pursued this with, that, well, there really is a hope. I mean, it's one in 10,000, but, gee, let's give it a try. And here's this person who may or may not want this aggressive treatment. Because our society refuses to address these issues. And we want doctors to talk to us, and doctors want us to talk to them. No one's really prepared to start the discussion. So in my personal life, I've started the discussion with our family doctor. He's very comfortable with what I want.
What have you told him?
I've told him in general that I don't regard 1 in 10,000 as a very realistic chance, and that if I'm in a condition like my mother's, I would just like to go peacefully. If I'm in that condition and the Cleveland Browns have a chance of winning the Super Bowl, then I'll take it. Keep me going for another 2 weeks. But I don't want to exist for a long period of time. If there's any meaningful chance of recovery, terrific, let's give it a shot. If there isn't, I don't really see the point. I'm not writing books, I'm not working, I'm not saving for my kids' future to have it all go down some hospital toilet.
At what point in your life do you think it would be appropriate to start talking about this with your children?
Well, I already have, and they don't want to. And my wife doesn't either. We're of different philosophies on this. But my wife has gone through some very painful decisions in her family as well. From that pain, she would rather not talk about it. From this pain, I say it stops here. You can't make people talk about it, and I don't blame the doctors for that. They can suggest it, and they do. People pick up on the euphemisms. You know, we're going to have to make some decisions here pretty soon. Those kinds of euphemisms, and they pick up on it. But I found by reconstructing my life and the values with my mother in some day that I was able to capture a lot of joy, which had been lost in the clinical sorrow of the passing at the end. I couldn't force anybody to make any other decisions, but I feel so relieved now, having gone through this process. It was a painful one, but I do think that given the alternatives, my parents always taught me there is a time to be born and a time to live, and there's a time, sadly, for passing. It happened with people in our family. It happened with my pets, and one worked very hard to make the passing as comfortable and peaceful as possible. For everyone concerned, including those living left behind.
Andrew Malcolm, I thank you very much for sharing some of this with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Andrew Malcolm has written a new book about his mother's passing. It's called Someday, The Story of a Mother and Her Son. And Andrew Malcolm is also national affairs correspondent for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Musicians can spend days or months trying to make a perfect recording. But record producer Joel Dorn is now more interested in performances where the musicians didn't even know they were being recorded. Coming up, Dorn talks with us about Night Records, his new label dedicated to finding the best live performances. Just a few months ago, Paul McCartney was performing in stadiums before audiences of tens of thousands. This week on MTV's concert series Unplugged, McCartney steps onto a much smaller stage. TV critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush says that he doesn't want the U.S. to be drawn into fighting in Iraq. Mr. Bush was responding to criticism that he had urged Iraqi citizens to rebel against Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, then failed to support them when they did. The president told reporters that he is increasingly frustrated by reports of atrocities against those who have rebelled. Mr. Bush said that he would be willing to take a new look at relations with Baghdad if Iraq's army were to overthrow the Iraqi leader.
The United States and these other countries with us in this coalition did not go there to settle only internal affairs of Iraq. I have said that there will not be normalized relations with Iraq as long as Saddam Hussein is in power. And of course I feel a frustration and a sense of grief for the innocents that are being killed brutally. But we are not there to intervene.
President Bush spoke to reporters at the end of his four-day vacation in Florida. In Iraq, government troops have retaken two cities in the northern part of the country, which had been captured by Kurdish forces. International relief workers believe that between 2 and 3 million people have fled their homes in northern Iraq, where the Kurdish uprising is being crushed by troops loyal to Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Civilian refugees say that they have been the target of government attacks. In Washington, the State Department said today that scattered fighting continues in both the northern and southern parts of Iraq. After UN Security Council approval of a UN ceasefire agreement in Iraq, Tennessee Senator Albert Gore criticized the Bush administration for not coming to the aid of Kurdish forces facing defeat at the hands of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's army. Nicholas Palugin reports.
Senator Al Gore said under the ceasefire agreement, the U.S. has the right to shoot down Iraqi helicopters used against the Kurds. But the Tennessee Democrat said after first encouraging rebellion, the administration now has other reasons for not aiding the Kurds.
The president has decided that we will let them fly and let them slaughter these Kurds because they've made a calculated decision that it's in our geopolitical interest for the forces of Saddam Hussein to reestablish control over Iraq.
Gore said the administration is afraid a Kurdish victory could splinter Iraq, leading to further instability in the region. For National Public Radio, this is Nicholas Palugin in Washington.
In Nevada, a major underground nuclear weapons test has been delayed because of winds blowing toward Las Vegas. The test has been rescheduled for tomorrow. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 18 points to close at 2,926.73. This is NPR News. In Albania, the opposition Democratic Party has called for a one-day general strike to protest the deaths of three people during violence that occurred after a communist election victory. One of those killed was trying to calm a crowd of people angry over the communist victory, and his slaying led to an all-out riot. More violence occurred last night in the capital, where witnesses said that riot police attacked a group of some 2,000 protesters who had spent the day peacefully protesting in front of Democratic Party headquarters. In Moscow, the Soviet parliament has turned down a plan by supporters of Boris Yeltsin for direct elections to fill a new position of executive president. The parliament voted instead for a more cautious plan to prepare legislation for that position without setting a firm timetable. Kevin Connolly, the BBC, reports from Moscow.
It was Mr. Yeltsin's opponents who called this Congress, determined to frustrate his drive for power and anxious, if they could, to unseat him. They found him, as always, in combative mood. He came armed with the approval of the Russian people for his plans to create a directly elected presidency. He'd be almost certain to win such a job, And if he did, he'd enjoy legitimacy and authority unparalleled in the history of the Soviet state. His supporters were hoping to capitalize on the momentum which his campaign against Mr. Gorbachev and the Soviet government has acquired in recent months. But their plans have now received a setback. The Congress has refused to endorse a proposal which suggested holding the elections in May or June. Instead, it's instructed the Russian Supreme Soviet to work on legislation setting up the presidency, but has set no timetable for elections. That doesn't help Mr. Yeltsin, but it means his plans are at least still on the political agenda.
Kevin Connolly, the BBC. In Yugoslavia, more troops have been sent to Croatia as the government called for an end to ethnic tensions in the area. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. That's Eddie Harris, recorded live in 1983 at Joel Siegel's Jazz Showcase in Chicago. Hearing musicians in concert will sometimes tell you things about them you might never have heard on more controlled studio sessions. My guest Joel Dorn has produced his share of studio dates by such performers as Bette Midler, the Neville Brothers, and Roberta Flack. He's produced 16 gold records. But his new record label, Night Records, is devoted to live recordings. What especially interests him is live recordings made by amateurs and club owners where the musicians didn't even realize they were being recorded. He's auditioned about 250,000 hours of tape so far. There are 4 records in the label's first release, featuring Eddie Harris, Russ and Roland Kirk, Cannonball Adderley, and Les McCann. You get to hear the musicians speak. Here's Harris again from a 1978 performance at the Keystone Corner in San Francisco.
While we're getting ready here, I would like to take time to inform you that the bassist is not late. They had a misunderstanding in the situation of the schedule this evening. So I want you to know that, those of you sitting out there mad at the bass player. You there? I just wanted to clear the air, you know, because that's where it used to be when I was coming in the club and the cat come in. Damn, I paid my money and the cat be late. He's not late. We were early, see?
So how'd you get access to these recordings? How did you even find out about the recordings that were done behind the musician's back?
I have a friend named Bernard Drayton, who is black. When he was young, which was the late 50s, early 60s, there were no black recording engineers in the studios in New York. There just weren't. But he wanted to become a recording engineer. So he bought his own little Radio Shack level remote equipment. I'm talking about a tape recorder, a microphone, a mixing board. Prevailed upon the jazz musicians in New York. He was one of those kids, you know, who was always backstage or trying to get in clubs or stuff. Prevailed upon the musicians that when they worked their gigs, not in Manhattan, not at Birdland or the Village Gate or those places, but when they worked out in the boroughs, Brooklyn, the Bronx, and these little tiny clubs, when they would get their material together for their recordings for the New York jazz labels, they let him record these gigs under the set of rules for it was you could never release it, and it was just, you know, basically it was give a brother a break, you know. They were letting him record these gigs so that he could learn how to become a recording engineer, and he did it with the understanding that he would never release them or play them for anybody else. Boom. It's 30 years later, I'm sitting in his office in November of 1986, and we had talked about these tapes off and on for years, and we had a meeting about something else and casually said to him, I said, Bernie, maybe we should do something with those tapes of yours. Now it's 30 years later. Let me see if I can go get the clearances. So I put the time in. We got the clearances.
Did your friend Bernie Drayton record the Eddie Harris record?
No. That was done by two people. Number one, a club owner in San Francisco named Todd Barkin, who had a club called Keystone Corner for 13 years. And very quietly, he recorded every single set by every artist that ever came through that place. He had a tape collection of close to 3,000 cassettes.
This is bootleg, too, right?
Well, bootleg's an interesting word. They're not bootlegs until you try and sell them. They're just unauthorized recordings or authorized but not for sale. I would say 80% of the cases the musicians didn't know. The Eddie Harris record was done partially in Todd Barkin's club. And then there's an interesting story. There is a club in Chicago where the owner is known to do some recording now and again when people aren't looking. Eddie Harris was playing this club, knew about it, brought a friend of his in who patched in to the house sound system behind the back of the man who was recording behind the back of Eddie Harris. And we got those tapes from Eddie Harris. So we had some stuff from San Francisco, some stuff from Chicago. We called it A Tale of Two Cities, you know.
No, and the Eddie Harris record, one of the tracks, has him doing basically like an impersonation of Billie Holiday, but he's not singing. He's kind of doing it into his saxophone.
That particular cut was done in San Francisco at the Keystone Corner. And what he does is he does an impersonation of Billie Holiday through some kind of electronic thing that he does through the saxophone, so he evokes that Billie Holiday sound without actually ever saying words. It's vocalese. But the strings and the piano, he plays them too. And they're operated by foot controls. So he stands on stage alone with a saxophone. It looks like he's playing it, but he's singing into it. With his left foot, he controls the piano. With his right foot, he controls the string orchestra. And he just does it.
Of the Ross and Roland Kirk sessions that you
used. Once again, that was done in San Francisco at Keystone Corner, but also in New Orleans and also in Paris. A variety of sources. We listened to 178 tapes to get, I think, 53 minutes of Rassan. And I had made 17 albums with him when he was alive, so while we found stuff that was releasable, I wanted to, once again, add to his body of recorded work. And do it in a way, we had a set of rules when he was alive that we would never do the same thing twice. So I didn't want to repeat things that he had done or areas he had covered.
You mentioned you recorded a lot of sessions with him. There's a great story that you have about how he tried to show you what it's like to be blind. He was a blind,
yeah, he was blind.
Saxophonist. So what's the story?
We went into mix one of his albums, which is where you take all the sound on the tape and put it in proportion and get it ready to be released as a record. Prior to mixing the album, he had casually said, we're not going to mix this record until you can mix it like me. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, sit down. And he's wrapping his stuff. He grabbed a roll of masking tape and started to wrap it around my head like mummy style. And he left a little room for me to breathe, but he wrapped my entire head in masking tape. After he wrapped the tape around my head, he put a gun to my head. And that... I stopped for a second. I said, what's going on? You know. He said, I want you to know what it feels like for me all the time, blind and with a gun to his head. He wasn't crazy, and it wasn't a hysterical scene. I think he was trying to make a point, obviously a point well taken with your head wrapped in a gun pointing at you. But I got the message.
My guest is Joel Dorn, the creator of Night Records, a new record label devoted to live music. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Record producer Joel Dorn is my guest. One of the things that Kirk used to always do at conferences was play three horns at one time, three saxophones at a time.
Right.
And you have an example of him doing that on the record. Why did you want to get an example of him doing that live?
Well, number one, it was kind of the thing that people spoke about. When you speak of Rassan Roland Kirk, they'll say, well, he was the blind guy who, and they'll always say, played three horns at once. That was, you know, his kind of his trademark. I remember the first time I saw it was in here in Philadelphia at the Academy of Music in 1961, and I was watching backstage when he put those three horns in his mouth. First time I saw him, he was imitating the Ellington horn section. And it absolutely, watching him do it and looking out from backstage and seeing the audience react, it was like, well, we're on radio, so opening my mouth doesn't make any difference. But everybody, you know, was like gasping.
Music. Let me say something against live records for a second.
Go.
And that is that, you know, sometimes an audience brings out the worst part of a musician. Sometimes the best, but sometimes the worst in the sense that the most show-busy parts of somebody's playing will really be brought out by, you know, lots of applause. You know, the most boring, long drum solo will get a ton of applause if the drummer's playing
right.
real fast.
Right. One of the reasons, I agree with you, one of the reasons that I feel real good about having a live label is I can sit there and only pick out what works.
Yeah.
So the self-indulgent, you know, those long, bizarre, I'm going to knock them on their, you know, off their feet kind of, you know, silly things, we don't have those.
Cannonball Adderley on the record with him. There's a beautiful recording of Stars Fell on Alabama.
Yeah.
Tell me something about this recording and why you included it.
Well, I listened to 520 tapes to get the Les McCann record, 60 tapes to get the Eddie Harris record, 178 tapes to get the Rahsaan Roland Kirk record, one tape to get the Cannonball Adderley, two tapes, I'm sorry, to get the Cannonball Adderley. It just jumped out of the, it was just one of those nights where everything was right. We got those tapes from Las Vegas, a disc jockey who moved there from New York, who had done some live radio shows at the Half Note. I was always a big Cannonball Adderley fan. I was thrilled. And interestingly, that was a very rare period for Cannon. It was just before he became a big kind of like pop jazz artist, and it was just at the end of when he was a major commercial jazz and artistic jazz success, kind of on the cusp of careers. The interesting thing about Stars Fell in Alabama, if you listen to it, or an interesting thing to me is that was done New Year's Eve in 1967, or New Year's Eve 68, whatever, however it goes, in New York, and musicians traditionally hate to play New Year's. It's the worst time in the world. Everybody's drunk, nobody cares, they're just out to scream and yell, you know, and get loaded. The audience is barely paying attention to him if you listen. There's a lot of noise. You hear all these conversations going on. And through all of this, on the worst night of the year for any musician, you just hear Cannon rise to this magnificent level. I thought that was a... He's recorded that song twice, and I heard him play it in person maybe a dozen times. He sounded like if Johnny Hodges and Bird had a son, it would have been Cannon then. And I thought it was a real touching performance.
Thank you.
me ask you, are any of the musicians getting angry at the people who recorded that, them without letting the musicians
sometimes
know what was happening?
I would say there are two instances in the 4.5 years we've been doing it where two people got livid. At that point, we gave them the tapes, said, you know, sorry, if you're bugged, they're yours. Talk to you later.
Yeah.
Here's what I found. When I first went into this, one of the reasons I approached it with some kind of trepidation was people used to get livid when they found that they were recorded in an unauthorized manner. It's 30 years later. A lot of times that's the best work they ever did, or that period's never coming back again, or they, instead of getting angry, they say, man, I thought I'd never hear me playing with so-and-so, or that was a great period, you know. So it's different now. Is it all peaches and cream? Absolutely not. But I'd say 85, 90% of the time people go, great, man, and love it.
Joel Dorn, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thanks.
Joel Dorn is the founder of Night Records. He's now working on an album by Mose Allison and an anthology of New Orleans pianists. Here's more from the Cannonball Adderley album, Radio Nights. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. We'll have a discussion of several things the White House could have done, a theory about this, to help support the Kurds and the Shiites fighting against the government of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. The Timberwind Project at the Pentagon, a report on this idea to use nuclear propulsion to send rockets into space. And we'll talk with the author of a book about the Pentagon's secret spending, Black Budgets, they're called, $100 million a day with not much congressional oversight. Timberwind would fit into the black budget concept. Also, our family series continues with a report on the difficulties of paying for a college education.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. MTV doesn't just show music videos. Among other things, they also have a weekly series called Unplugged that cuts against the grain of most of the network's programming. It features rock stars in a quiet setting playing unamplified instruments in front of a small audience. TV critic David Bianculli says this week Unplugged gets its biggest guest yet.
Well, she's the one in the red blue jean. She's the queen of all. She's the woman that loves me so. Be-ba-ba-lula, she's my baby. Be-ba-ba-lula, don't mean baby. Be-ba-ba-lula, she's my baby.
When Paul McCartney left the Beatles and started Wings, his dream was to get back, so to speak, to the days of playing in a small club. Well, it didn't work with Wings, and it took some 20 years. But McCartney finally got his wish.
Welcome to Unplugged, the program where everybody takes their plugs out and goes mad. Now, I'm going to play a song which was the first song I ever wrote when I was 14.
Well, I woke up late this morning, my head was in.
Okay, so it sounds like the first song he ever wrote. But it's fun to hear, and fun seems to be the operative word here. McCartney enjoyed himself so much, in fact, that he's decided to release a limited edition CD next month called Unplugged, the Official Bootleg, with even more songs than the 13 included in the MTV program. Except for a new drummer, the band backing McCartney is the same as on last year's world tour. Robbie McIntosh on guitar, Hamish Stewart on bass, Paul Wicks Wickens on keyboards, and Linda McCartney behind them. Not doing much, but not getting in the way either. As for Paul, he really seems to be enjoying himself. He's loose. Sometimes very loose.
Try to see it my way.
I only got the words wrong, didn't I? Been a long time. This is so informal, we'll start again.
Try to see it in my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can't go on? Why do you see it your way? For the risk of knowing that love may not last long. We can work it out. We can work it out. Think of what you're saying.
The second half of the concert is especially good, and Stewart's harmonies blend nicely with McCartney, even on familiar songs from the Beatles days. Of course, since it's been 20 years since the Beatles split up, it's possible that not all these songs are familiar to today's MTV audience. In fact, McCartney points out in his introduction to Blackbird that a young MTV technician referred to the song in rehearsal as Blackboard. But after all the years of carrying around Beatle baggage, McCartney seems more delighted than offended. This Unplugged special is delightful too, and its success and attention ought to bring even more artists to this defiantly acoustic showcase. Elton John and Crosby, Stills, and Nash have already visited. My votes for future participants would include Paul Simon, Hot Tuna, Jackson Browne, Randy Newman, and Ry Cooter, who get little or no MTV time as it is. But for now, I'll settle for McCartney. This week, at least, Unplugged should not go unwatched.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Roberta Shurrock, Joan Tui, and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Tracy Hildebrandt, Sue Labadie, and Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
You're only waiting for this moment to be free. You're only waiting for this moment to be free. You were only waiting for this moment to be free.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano won the American Book Award for his trilogy on the Americas, Memory of Fire. On the next edition of Fresh Air, Galeano tells us about living in exile and returning home when his country returned to democracy. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.